Metzger, Terrible Tommy, come on down. You're the host of the Insurgent Radio Network, broadcasting live from the bunker in North Central Indiana, right next to Terrible Tommy's Terrible Tavern, where the elite meet to eat, but mostly drink. Also nearby is Terrible Tommy's Weapons of Mass Destruction Used Equipment Yard, where you can purchase a freshly refurbished weapon of mass destruction for pennies on the dollar, if the price is right. You can reach Tom at P.O. Box 401, Warsaw, Indiana, 46581. Address your letters and mail to Tom Metzger, the Insurgent, or just plain old box holder. Good old Tommy will get it.
We got a note in here from Stray Dog back in New Germany, and he's sending us some information on how the Orthodox Jews are trying to flex their muscles as usual. So let's listen to our beautiful announcer, She-Wolf, explain.
Hi, TT. They are at it again, God's chosen peoples. Jews are trying to expand their Lakewood, New Germany empire into neighboring Tuns River. That's the town that the Jews got caught dumping 100,000 tons of trash into our Pine Barrens that sits above the town's freshwater aquifer. Tom's River is fighting the Jews. Yeshiva group claims hostility against Jewish Orthodox. June 8, 2016. Ocean Township, New Jersey. A religious group claims open hostility towards the Orthodox Jewish community is the reason a permit application for a Talmudic academy has been denied twice here. Township officials said they are the ones under attack by the group for exercising their right to deny an application that does not meet its municipal land use laws. A federal judge is expected to rule on the matter at a hearing scheduled for late July. Yeshiva Gedola Naos Yaakov, based in Lakewood, filed an amended complaint with a federal judge Thursday, just over a month after its second application for a use variance permit to renovate an existing Jewish day school building was denied. The group asks that the judge reverse the zoning board denial of its application and award it compensatory damages. The complaint stated local residents' opposition to its proposal was motivated by hostility toward the Orthodox Jewish community, claiming residents packed board hearings, purposely delaying the process. It said the result was that the span of the public meetings went nearly 400 days over the statutory limit of 120 days set by New Jersey law. The board simply ignored its obligation and improperly denied the yeshiva use variance relief, crumbling to the demands of a very large and vocal crowd of objectors, said Donna M. Jennings of the firm Willens, Goldman and Spitzer, one of the group's attorneys. The group is also represented by Roman P. Stortzer, whose office is based in Washington, D.C., and whose name is on the complaint. I think it is disheartening that they would accuse the township of this. It's always been an inclusive town with many denominations that have many uses here, said Mayor Christopher P. Siciliano. The township has always saw this as a zoning issue, not a religious issue. The group, however, alleges the township's land use ordinances discriminated against its constitutional rights. The group wants to renovate a Jewish day school at 1515 Logan Road into an academy with dormitories for 96 men between ages 18 and 22, which is not a permitted use in the township. The school presently serves kindergarten through fifth grade. It has always operated as a private school and was once owned by the Hillel Yeshiva School on Deal Road, according to township officials. According to Siciliano, the group has a contract to purchase the school and is also seeking injunctive relief to allow it to start doing renovations to open in September. The group was first turned down by the board on December 1 after more than a year of public hearings. That included a July hearing that was adjourned by the fire marshal because the meeting room, a high school auditorium, was over its capacity. Over 1,000 people turned out. The board denied the use on the recommendation of its attorney Mark Steinberg, who said the board didn't have sufficient information before it to render a decision. Steinberg also said the board did not get time to hear from all the objectors. Steinberg declined to comment to a reporter when called at his Neptune-based law office. The group then filed a federal lawsuit alleging the township and zoning board violated its constitutional rights, the Federal Religious Land Use and Institutionalized Persons Act, and the Fair Housing Act. The United States District Judge Frieda L. Wolfson then required the board hold two more hearings on April 5 and April 25. The board denied the group on the grounds that the site was never meant to board that many adults and that the restrictions the applicant would impose on its students, such as no smoking, no cell phones, no parking on streets, would be difficult to enforce and would place an undue burden on the township and residents.
Well, thanks, Stray Dog, for that report on what's going on in your community. It's great when these people stand up in mass and say, "No, Jaime, not here." Following is an expose of Operation Northwoods that was created back in the hysteria of the anti-Cuban situation. But it's an example of how the federal government, or perhaps any government, could arrange to have things be what they're not and hoodwink the public and get you clamoring for warfare and all that kind of stuff. So here we go.
It is possible to create an incident which will demonstrate convincingly that a... It is possible to create an incident which will demonstrate convincingly that a Cuban aircraft has attacked and shot down a chartered civil airliner en route from the United States to Jamaica, Guatemala, Panama, or Venezuela. The destination would be chosen only to cause the flight plan route to cross Cuba. The passengers could be a group of college students off on a holiday, or any grouping of persons with a common interest to support chartering a non-scheduled flight. An aircraft at Eglin Air Force Base would be painted and numbered as an exact duplicate for a civil registered aircraft belonging to a CIA proprietary organization in the Miami area. At a designated time, the duplicate would be substituted for the actual civil aircraft and would be loaded with the selected passengers, all boarded under carefully prepared aliases. The actual registered aircraft would be converted to a drone. Takeoff times of the drone aircraft and the actual aircraft will be scheduled to allow a rendezvous south of Florida. From the rendezvous point, the passenger-carrying aircraft will descend to minimum altitude and go directly into an auxiliary field at Eglin Air Force Base, where arrangements will have been made to evacuate the passengers and return the aircraft to its original status. The drone aircraft, meanwhile, will continue to fly the filed flight plan. When over Cuba, the drone will be transmitting on the international distress frequency a Mayday message stating he is under attack by a Cuban MiG aircraft. The transmission will be interrupted by destruction of the aircraft, which will be triggered by radio signal. It is possible to create an incident which will make it appear that communist Cuban MiGs have destroyed a United States Air Force aircraft over international waters in an unprovoked attack. At precisely the same time that aircraft was presumably shot down, a submarine or small surface craft would disperse F-101 parts, parachute, etc., at approximately 15 to 20 miles off the Cuban coast and depart. The pilots returning to Homestead would have a true story as far as they knew. Search ships and aircraft could be dispatched and parts of aircraft found. So, you know, we shouldn't think that certain people within the U.S. government can't plant evidence at staged terror attacks.
Well, when you have the ability to make everything that's going on in Washington top secret and nobody can get to it, they can do anything. And then they call it a democracy? That's the biggest scam that's ever been promoted, that we live under a democracy. It's been a dictatorship for a long time. Well, there's an article come out about the Democrats are now the aggressive war party, and I'll be sending that to you, but in the meantime, I'm going to read you a letter that was in response to that article. And let me get that up here on the screen. It's the title is My Daddy Told Me. My dad was a key figure in U.S. politics, often taking positions which I disagree today. He ran primaries, worked for the White House, where he put together a slick booklet with lots of photos for Harry S. Truman, called Swords into Plowshares, precisely to counter the perception of the Democratic administrations as war hawks. My dad always would say around the breakfast table that foreign relations never decide elections. They are of vital importance to many of us since that era. It was preordained that HRC would not feature her foreign policy experience in her campaign. It would be like a student claiming years at a college while neglecting to mention all failing grades for Hillary Rodham Clinton's campaign. Foreign policy would be underplayed, not mentioned at all if possible, defending when directly attacked by an adversary with no experience in foreign policy himself or in dealing with the interlocking interest groups which live off the increased production of machines of death, the weapons lobby, AIPAC, NRA, and so on. I can accept Perry's belief that Barack Obama was a reluctant warrior, but not very reluctant at all. He was a great showman. Statements filled with good intentions and governmental meaningless on Social Security. He represents one more example of a war hawk with oratorical style. So Robert Perry has allowed himself to become part and parcel of the general Democratic plan. In fact, Donald Trump may himself be contributing to Hillary Rodham Clinton's deceptions. Those of us who are on the left, admittedly an ancient phrase, must perceive how we have in so many ways been co-opted. We quickly forget the predatory drones, the assassinations, the daily murders, the rapes, aggression by Israel, hiding thereby the sins of our friends, which makes those others seem nothing by comparison. So there you go. Another interesting article from the so-called left. Robert, you're singing to the choir on this one, but it's a very thorough song. You could mention the important role that Putin played, given John Kerry making a slip in a public talk and Putin jumping in for peace. My only issue with the article is that you assume Clinton, the presumptive nominee of the Democrats, hasn't captured that role yet. There are several hurdles for her to make. One, Clinton has to avoid criminal indictment for her breaches of national security when she used a private server. So far, she's done a pretty good job of that, because the Attorney General is not going to back the FBI in arresting her. That's Tommy's comment. Two, Clinton has several problems of a medical nature that have not yet been exposed, but which make her unfit to be president. And this, too, might make a difference to turn her superdelegates. Finally, I think this is the big one today, and a topic on which Reuters just published an article today. And I'll have to try to open that up and see what it is. Number three, for Clinton to win, she needs the support of Bernie Sanders' crowd. She won't get it. So if the superdelegates and the party leaders don't want their candidate to suffer a crushing defeat and drag down the congressional and senatorial Democratic candidates, they will be forced to find a way to eject their candidate who is truly horrible. And that's from the left of center. There's another comment letter, and which underlines what I told you a long time ago when this primary first started. Given Donald Trump's hostile takeover of the Republican Party and his disdain for neocon strategies he views as simply spreading chaos around the globe, unquote. Those are my words, baby. Wrong, wrong, wrong. The Trump populist insurgency meme was concocted, now get this, thus saith Tommy, was concocted by the Republican Party machine to win big in the next election. Obviously, there is no political need to demonstrate the GOP's devotion as an aggressive war party or its commitment to virtually every position of the Netanyahu government of Israel. Trump is decidedly not hostile to the neocon project for a new century. Trump will continue to perform the assigned outsider and maverick reality TV role, a cynical facade that will evaporate if the Republicans are allowed to regain full control of both White House and Congress. Very interesting. Rest assured, if either Trump or Clinton are elected president, neocon strategies will continue spreading chaos around the globe. Sanders staying in the fight represents a slim hope of thwarting the neocon project that launched in 2000 and was advanced in 2008 and threatens a radioactive final solution post-2016. The Sanders campaign will be well advised to fully expose the joint Trump-Clinton neocon project. Sanders should immediately produce the 21st century version of the Daisy ad with Trump and Clinton alternating the countdown. Remember that ad they put out that sunk Barry Goldwater's campaign with the little girl picking a flower and a nuclear mushroom in the background? That was a very effective ad for the Democrats. Anyhow, I told you so. So there's other people have the same opinion on this, and these people are not from even our side of the fence. If there is a side to the fence. Well, it looks like some of our opponents are about to suffer the same problems that a lot of us do. Yeah, up in Chicago. The Chicago ordinance would make protesting police abuses a hate crime. Yeah, there you go. I keep telling these people all these laws could be turned around and used against you. Alderman Edward M. Burke has introduced an ordinance to expand Chicago's hate crime ordinance to include any offense against police officers or firefighters. It is the goal of this ordinance to give the prosecutors and judges every tool to punish those who interfere with or threaten or physically assault our public safety personnel, unquote. Sounds fairly decent on paper, but it doesn't work out that way. Co-chairman Ted Pearson of the Chicago Alliance Against Racist and Political Repression, who is definitely not our friend, blasted the proposed ordinance. This is an attempt to intimidate the movement for community control of the police by suggesting that protests against police crimes are hate crimes. Yeah, It's potentially intimidating, Pearson said, because people who protest police crimes could be charged under this law. Well, we thought it was only going to happen to the right-wing Klan and stuff like that. This is adding insult to injury to those who are outraged when police murder an unarmed person in protest, he said. He cited the 2012 murder by police of Jamal Moore, 23, who was unarmed. Scores of people from the neighborhood at Garfield Boulevard and Ashland Avenue angrily protested the murder, and several were arrested. Quote, would people in such circumstances now be charged with a hate crime against the police under this new law? Unquote. Well. Seems like the worm has turned, and what I had predicted at the close of the civil trial against me in Portland, Oregon, I said they'll be using all this crap against everybody sooner or later. They started using it against anti-abortion people right after they came at me, and now they're getting around to using it against the progressive left. So that's going to be interesting to see that. So maybe pretty soon, every time these people turn out and have a demonstration against Trump or something like that, they'll end up being charged with a hate crime. I love it. Chaos is wonderful. Mainly because it's got a two-edged sword, baby. And this was a small article out of Chicago about their crime wave up there. A recent report from Chicago in the New York Times provided a relentlessly grim window on a city where gun, mostly Negro, violence has become the terrifying norm. A team of reporters spent Memorial Day long weekend documenting every shooting in Chicago, a weekend in which 64 people were shot, most of them in the ghetto. Six of them were killed. It was just a three-day glimpse of a year in which so far 1,607 people have been shot in just over 5 months. I guess fortunately most of them were blacks shooting blacks. A local website has crunched the numbers to show this represents one person shot in the Windy City every 2 hours and 22 minutes. This puts a lie to the fact that the Ku Klux Klan was a major instigator of violence against blacks, because there's no comparison to the small amount of reality crimes by the Klan against blacks. Blacks are the best Klansmen in the world. Yeah, the Chicago Klan, they do a great job. Those sad, scary numbers and the human agony documented by Times reporters that keeps these statistics from numbing the real pain they represent offer a bracing, clarifying perspective of Toronto's own recent spike in gun crime. Because Chicago is not Detroit, a city gutted by hard economics and once deserted by its middle class. Nor is it Rio de Janeiro or Bogota, Colombia, cities in the post-colonial, color them evil, those colonialists, developing countries whose economies have been dominated by the international illegal drug trade, which is pretty much controlled by the CIA and other people like that. Because if they didn't want it to happen, it wouldn't be happening, believe me. They have the power to stop it if they really want to. In fact, Chicago is much like Toronto, an affluent, often celebrated Great Lakes city known for long-suffering sports fans, one that is an economic, political, and tourism powerhouse in its regions. In fact, from time to time, whether you're talking about waterfront revitalization or architecture or economic development, Chicago is cited as a city we can learn from. We can learn a lot about race, I'll tell you that, but they don't really want to talk about that, do they? Toronto has been becoming in many ways more like Chicago from the size of its population to the density of skyscrapers to the racial geographic sorting. That's a clever use of three words, racial geographic sorting. Well, why don't you just come out and say how many blacks are killing blacks? Or how many blacks are killing whites? Why don't you give those figures? Huh? Why not tell the truth? Because you don't have the balls to do it. You're scared. You're scared that the blacks will stomp their feet and cry racism. Well, racism's good. Racism's wonderful. And I love racism, man. I'd never deny being a racist, like even a lot of the Klan leaders say, well, we're not really racist, even though we don't like black people. You could tell the truth. Why don't people just tell the truth? Lay it out there the way it is. It's a similarity that ought to make us look at the gun violence in Chicago as a cautionary tale and ask what we can learn from its example to avoid finding ourselves in its situation. Well, you will, believe me or not. There may be an impulse to take solace in a story like this, which shows that even in a period where we are worrying about our worst gun crime rate in years, of course, the guns just walk around and shoot people. They act like there's nobody pulling the trigger, or they don't want to identify the people that are pulling the trigger, or they don't want to identify the race of the people pulling the trigger in most cases. Similarly sized, Chicago has had 8.5 times more murders. If you could magically take the whole population of blacks out of Chicago and hold them on some secluded place for a few weeks, you'd see the crime and shooting in Chicago go almost to zero. Anyhow, to smugly conclude that we have no real problem at all by comparison. We have gun control in Canada, and Toronto remains, after all, among the very safest large cities in the world to live. Certainly, we should count our blessings that we are relatively safe, but I think that would be the wrong conclusion to draw if we go no farther. Yeah. Because the detailed reporting gives a glimpse into the situation, it's all too easy to imagine. Here, a cycle of revenge among, I'll put in here, black and mestizo gang members that leads to an arms race, making carrying guns ever more common. Pockets of racially stratified city in which young people see gangs as a rung on the ladder out of poverty, an inspiration, as one former member put it, as a way to make a little money and just to be a part of something, man, unquote. A mistrust of police among the general public that grows so profound, people refuse to cooperate. People, this is mostly the black people, even driving themselves to the hospital after being shot rather than calling authorities. Well, they know that they're being charged with some kind of crime. Even if you're the victim, you'll probably get charged with a crime. Leaving a police force technologically hyper-equipped but unable to stop crimes they all but know are going to happen. Well, my suggestion, first of all, is make all cops in the ghetto black. If you go back and trace the records of how it used to be with black communities being policed by black cops, it was quite peaceful, way more peaceful than today, because black cops were far more brutal than any white cop could ever be. We are not there in Toronto, but there are some trends of all these areas that point to the same direction. But perhaps more importantly, we cannot take comfort in the comparison because we have our own stories to look at, and they are heartbreaking. Like this one, Candace Rochelle Bob, a pregnant mother shot and killed last month, her infant child delivered by C-section as she died before dying weeks later. On the same block where less than a year earlier, 14-year-old Leeson Ross died from a gunshot wound while visiting a 10-year-old neighbor. A 10-year-old boy struck by a bullet while watching television in his own home. Cynthia Mulapudi, a recent university graduate and hospital volunteer, gunned down in the back seat of a car driven by a man she had just met through a mutual friend. Now, I wonder how white these people were, or the people who perpetrated the crime. I'll bet you 95-98% were black. But they don't want to talk about that, do they? So, worse is better for now. They're going to have to learn the hard way. If you don't listen, you'll have to feel. Let's see. Homicide figures in Toronto. Let's see. Gee, in 2005, there were 52. Okay. And so far in 2016, there's been 21. But as the blacks spread their population all around the country and into Canada and other places, you're going to have more and more murders. Duh. The Black Ku Klux Klan is on the move. On the move. Let's see here. The longer you wait to really solve the problem, the worse it's going to get. I'm telling you, because the virus is spreading, like in Chicago, spreading out into Indiana. The ghetto has taken over northeast or northwest Indiana. They've spread down to Indianapolis, Indiana, and, of course, in all these other surrounding places like Milwaukee and all over the place. So the virus is spreading, man. Well, here's a few paragraphs on a recent research paper done on crime and murder in Chicago. And it pretty much follows every other major city. A large body of research documents the importance of early experiences for later academic, social, and economic success. Exposure to an unsafe neighborhood, i.e., Negro or Mexican or mestizo, is no exception. That's my comment. Living in a violent neighborhood can influence the stress levels, protective behaviors, and community interactions of both parents and children in ways that generate cumulative educational disadvantage. In other words, they get more stupid than they normally are. Using 9 years from 2002 to 2011 of detailed crime data from the Chicago Police Department and longitudinal administration data from the Chicago Public Schools, I estimate the influence of early exposure to neighborhood violence on the growth in standardized test scores over time. Well, that's like trying to study a college course while you're in trench warfare in a war. Or in a foxhole. You know, I don't think you're going to do too good no matter how smart you are. Student effects are included to remove any bias due to constant differences between the students. Yeah, but you won't add in the fact that it's a majority black or mestizo or in some cases Asian. The results shown that children from more violent neighborhoods fall farther behind their peers from safer neighborhoods as they progress through the school. See, now they've got another excuse to hang their hat on here, you know. It's just the violence. Normally blacks are geniuses, but it's just violence that screws them up. These effects are comparable in size to the independent association with socioeconomic disadvantage. Boy, they like those big words, don't they? And an annual measure of more recent neighborhood violence exposure. Well, you know what causes it. Innate inequality and inability to cut the mustard. Evolutionary retardation, all that kind of stuff, and then pile on that and everybody's shooting at each other. What a fall. So the elephant in the parlor, you know what it is, I know what it is. And since they're not going to face it, the problem's going to get worse and worse and worse and worse. Now, if you think it's bad here, over in Europe now, where they're being bombarded with all of these invaders, they're more liberal than they are in this country, a lot more liberal. And Germany's failing to attack an increase in hate crime. Failed responses to the sharp increase in hate crimes across Germany, or I say simply crimes, including attacks on shelters for asylum seekers. Yeah, right, because asylum seekers are raping and killing people that are not in the shelters. Expose the need to urgently step up protection and launch an independent inquiry into the possible bias within the country's law enforcement agencies, said Amnesty International in a report released today. You see, they're blaming the regular citizens for their violence and reacting against these invaders. The report is Living in Insecurity, How Germany is Failing Victims of Racist Violence. But it's on the other side. It's all reversed. It's turned upside down. Details how 16 times as many crimes were reported against asylum shelters in 2015, 1,031, as in 2013, 63. More generally, racist violent crimes against racial, ethnic, and religious minorities increased 87% from 693 crimes in 2013 to 1,295 crimes in 2015. Well, tell them to go home. Return them to their lands, you know, and quit bombing the shit out of their countries, too. Tell the United States and these countries to get out of there and take their drones and stick them up their ass. And then send these people back, because there's going to be a lot more so-called crimes against these invaders, because it's not crime, it's the self-defense of these countries in Europe. That's the way it is. Now they're crying because there's not enough police action against the people who are defending their neighborhoods from the invaders. Quote, with hate crimes on the rise in Germany, long-standing and well-documented shortcomings in the response of law enforcement agencies to racist violence must be addressed. Well, some of these invaders are probably white. I mean, you know, not everybody in the Middle East is non-white. Quote, German federal and state authorities need to put in place comprehensive risk assessment strategies. They love those big words. To prevent attacks against invaders. Further police protection is urgently needed for shelters identified at high risk of attack. And these shelters are also used for, obviously, terrorists to hide around in, and also for just plain lowlifes who want to go out and rape some white girls. While the German public has been among Europe's most welcoming to refugees, invaders, well, that's because they're stupid. As many as 6 anti-refugee protests were staged weekly throughout 2015. Well, that doesn't do the job. You can protest till your ass falls off. It takes physical confrontation. Many asylum seekers and refugees who were attacked, and in fact, it takes confrontation with the government. Not so much the asylum seekers as the government itself. Okay, many asylum seekers and refugees who were attacked or whose friends or acquaintances were attacked. Of course, they never attack anybody. The invaders never attack anybody. Told Amnesty that they are now live in fear and no longer feel safe. Well, go home. Go home if you feel that unsafe. Saiwan B, an ethnic Kurd who fled Syria, was attacked in Dresden in 2015, told Amnesty, all my friends were afraid after the attack against me. I escaped a war in Syria and I don't need to face tensions here in Germany. Well, you will. I just would like to work and to have a good life as I had before the war. Well, go home and straighten out your own country and tell the U.S. to get their goddamn troops out of Syria and their planes quit flying around. That's one way to do it. That's the way I would do it. Now, the statistics, and not only in England and Germany, but England, are becoming quite public now of hundreds and thousands of white girls that are being raped all over Europe and all over England. And the press are keeping a lid on it as much as they can, but it's beginning to leak out. Really amusing, almost, that a whole different racial, religious, cultural group of people, like a million, can come into your country, and when you resist, you're the enemy. Well, that's right out of Soviet Principle 10, that if you resist us invading and bringing communism into your country, then you are the criminal. Because we're bringing love and comfort and wonderful things to you through the blessings of communism, and by you resisting that, you are the criminal. So you're going to be arrested, put in a concentration camp, because you didn't welcome our communist program with love and affection. And that's exactly what's happening now all over the world, especially in white countries. The Soviet system was not defeated. They certainly went broke, but all their social programs of the Soviet Union were exported right into Europe and the United States. Well, I think for the rest of the program, we're going to get back on Might is Right, our favorite book, or one of our favorite books, which really puts it out there straight. And if you can't handle that, well, I don't know what to tell you. Here we go. Might is Right by Ragnar Redbeard. Chapter 3.
The web. Just as the spider weaves his silk.
Chapter 3. The Spinning of the Web. Just as the spider weaves his silky web to lure flies into the larder of his banqueting hall in order that he may at his leisure pick the flesh off their bones, so deceitful ideals are cunningly woven by dexterous political spiders to capture and exploit swarms of human flies. What are the grandiose paragraphs of the Declaration of Independence but the weft and woof of a dazing spider web? And what are the American people but the flies that have been cleverly entangled in its gossamer meshes? For over a century, this declaration has been the parchment divinity of all public orators, from the curbstone dervish at the street corner to our elective monarch in the White House. Every 4th of July, Americans habitually scream themselves hoarse over its sounding generalities, making the welkin ring with tin horns, giant firecrackers, flag idolatry, brass bands, toy pistols, and herd bellowing generally. Although the great majority of them are mental and physical dwindlings, poverty-stricken and propertyless, yet how insanely they delight in amusing a sardonic world with their loquacious, flamboyant charlatanry. "We are sovereigns and equals," is their everlasting Barmecide chorus. Sovereigns and equals. In all lunatic asylums may be found inmates who fancy themselves kings and queens and lords of the earth. These sorrowful creatures, if only permitted to wear imaginary crowns and issue imaginary commands, are the most docile and harmless of all maniacs. As for the American people of today, is not their written constitution but a cunningly constructed straitjacket, their moral codes padded prison cells, their statute laws handcuffs and leg irons, their captains of industry keepers and turnkeys in clever disguise? 100 years ago, they ostensibly commenced independent operations with the richest continent on earth as their private property, their subscribed capital, and during the whole of that period, have they not been as busy as so many relays of draft beasts of burden, pumping the tremendous natural wealth out of their home soil and pouring it oversea into the cesspools of Europe? Is not that the work of lunatics? They smashed and splintered the wooden political yoke of an English king, and then proceeded to rivet around their necks a brand new yoke of bolted steel, which they forged especially to fit themselves and which they dignified under the name of constitutional freedom. Is not that also the work of lunatics? Cursed indeed are the harnessed ones. Cursed are they even though their harness be homemade. Even though it tinkle musically with silver bells, aye, even though every buckle and link and rivet thereof is made of solid gold. How absurd of men to hurrah over their glorious political liberty, who have not even been able to retain possession of the substantial products of their own laboriousness. After a century of constitutional progress, 10% of the population are absolute owners of 92% of all the property. Now, O reader, are not these things the outward invisible sign of organic dementia? 2. The Declaration of Independence commences by proclaiming an unctuous falsehood, a black, degrading, self-evident lie, a lie which no one could possibly believe but a born fool. With insolent effrontery, it brazenly proclaims as a self-evident truth that all men are created equal, and that they are endowed by their Creator with certain inalienable rights. Rights which it thereupon proceeds to define in canting phraseology, imbecile and florid as it is false. Indeed, the mock heroic preamble of this rhetorical pronunciamento is but a cunningly constructed piece of blague deliberately intended to deceive and betray. Indeed, the mock heroic preamble of this rhetorical pronunciamento is but a cunningly constructed piece of blague deliberately intended to deceive and betray. It consists of a patchwork of plagiarized catchwords annexed wholesale from the ravings of 17th-century levelers, crazed puritanic matoids, and 18th-century cretinous French Jacobins, all mixed up and jumbled together with a long rigmarole of semi-meaningless pretty phrases culled mostly from an old-time melodrama. The Declaration of Independence has less real meaning for present conditions than a bottled-up Indian war whoop of the same period would have if uncorked now. It is a back number, musty, high-smelling, and worm-eaten, only fit for the walls of a museum or the brain cells of a daft philosopher. Its ethical and most of its political conclusions are shams, deceptions, and cold-blooded dishonesties, incandescent lies, glorified, belauded, printed in letters of gold, but nevertheless lies. Indeed, it has always been considered a piece of amusing mockery by those who really understood the secret intent for which it was originally constructed, viz., as a lasso for the bellowing herds that above 100 years ago were beginning to run wild and escape from their herdsmen and herdsmen's stock whip in this then boundless new world. To all contemporary demagogues, the high-sounding phraseology of the Declaration is as honey from paradise. Everywhere its seductive abstractions are the avatars of anarchism, communism, republicanism, and scores of other zymotic convulsionisms. Why then should sane men continue giving lip service to this subtle deception? Why should they, by their silence, acquiesce in the malefic efforts of organic weaklings? Instigated by prattlers of a false philosophy, to enforce by electioneering mass pressure an impossible and hideous equality ideal? Every national appeal is now made not to the noblest and the best, but to the riffraff, the slave hordes, who possess less intelligence than night owls. All that is brave, honorable, heroic is ignored tacitly, for fear of offending the deified herd, the majority. Equality of conditions is its debasing shibboleth, and verily he who has temerity enough to spit upon equality is liable to be horned to death. The voice of the people can only be compared to the fearsome shrieks of agony that may now and then be heard issuing forth from the barred windows of a roadside madhouse. The voice of God. Alas, alas. 3. There are two methods whereby masterful, ambitious men may hold any population in a state of ordered subjectivity. The first and by far the most honorable method is through an irresistible and highly trained standing army, ready to deploy anywhere with mechanical precision at a telegraphic nod in order to lay down the law at the cannon's mouth and sweep away all dangerous opposition. The second and cheaper method is, first of all, to inoculate those intended to be exploited with some poisonous political soporific, superstition, or theora. Something that, operating insidiously, hypodermically, may render them laborious, meek, and tractable. The latter plan has ever proved itself most effective because Aryan populations that would fight to the last gasp against undisguised military despotism may be induced to passively submit to any indignity or extortion if their brains are first carefully soaked in some abstract lie. At the period of the War of Independence, North America was far too wide, far too sparsely settled, and far too poor in concentrated wealth to be effectively ruled and plundered upon the standing army principles either by King George or the successful junta of power-wielding revolutionists. Hamilton, Hancock, Jefferson, Adams, Madison, Henry, and all the vested material interests that stood a solid phalanx behind these voluble patriots cast about for some safer method of ruling the minds of the uninformed but extremely valorous yeomanry, backwoodsmen, and mountaineers. After mature consideration, they determined to lull and lure the armed peasantry back again into a condition of blissful somnolence by instilling into their newly aroused minds false but seductive political idealisms, as subtle supplements to the fallacious and equally delusive but pre-existent religionisms and moralisms. This cunning plot worked like a charm, for equity of rights seemed to puritanic minds the logical outcome of that other hoary old lie, equality before God. What a set of damned rascals they were, was Governor Morris's terse, rugged, but ever memorable description of the Congress of smart corruptionists that adopted and formally proclaimed those famous and fatal abstractions. Thereupon, the sword of power that conquered on the battlefield was carefully hidden away out of sight, and constitutionalism invoked to aid in the reharnessing of the conquerors of Cornwallis by their new masters. The old systems of jurisprudence and government, founded on naked force, were cleverly retained, even amplified, and at the same time the white-skinned populations were cunningly proclaimed free and equal. Never having enjoyed genuine personal freedom, except on the Indian border, being for the most part descendants of hunted-out European starvelings and fanatics, defeated battlers, they now stupidly thought that they had won freedom at last by the patent device of selecting a complete outfit of new tax-gatherers every fourth year. 4. When we look back upon the childlike faith in constitutionalism displayed by our revolutionary fathers, together with their infantile republican specifics for the redemption of mankind, we cannot help smiling. At every general election since 1776, Americans have voted solidly for increasing the despotic authority of their elective rulers and taskmasters. Personal liberty is very nearly unknown, except in the newspaper. And any citizen who dares to think in direct opposition to the dogma of the majority does so at the risk of his life, if he thinks too loudly. Indeed, men of initiative and enterprise are now in the regular habit of purchasing immunity from communal molestation by bribing legislatures and officials upon a wholesale scale. The state is a blackmail agency. Enterprises necessitating state permits and large preliminary expenditures of capital cannot be safely undertaken until elective satraps, aldermen, judges, governors, congressmen, presidents, senators, etc., have first negotiated a percentage rake-off. Neither life nor property is safe from the malignance, revenge, or greed of government officials or their confederates. He who would assert himself in this republic under present conditions must be a man of unscrupulous acumen.
Do you know your exact life purpose? You know your destiny. I'm going to show you three ways.
Acumen and shrewdness. He must know the exact price of every patriot with whom business brings him in contact and be ready to pay it without demur, nay, with an appearance of haughty enthusiasm. Otherwise, it will go hard with him. Should he be a poor man, his chances in life are infinitesimal, so long as he is conscientious. No citizen can call his soul his own who dares to openly attack the administrative scoundrelism. scoundrelism based securely upon purchasable majority votes. Those thievish officials, percolators of Turkey, China, Persia, and Morocco, would hang their heads in utter shame at their own clumsy methods of robbery if they once beheld the magnificent mechanism and finesse wherewith American politicians enrich themselves by bleeding the treasuries, stealing public lands, and sweating the revenues. Indeed, our grand viziers, heaven bless them, not only plunder living generations, but they even make futurity contribute to their hungry rapacity. Their schemes of financial legerdemain are of unparalleled brilliance and grandeur. They borrow thousands of millions upon national credits from the usurers, and then proceed to apportion the money unto each other under the elaborate pretense of needful public expenditure, redeeming the currency, etc., etc., in order that the Jew may be secured in his usurious shent per shent. Oppressive taxes are laid on the peasantry wherewith to pay the annual interest charge upon the bonded millions. All of these tributes are collectible in appreciating gold at the point of the Supreme Court's bayonet. However, military assistance is very seldom needed to enforce the tax collectors' demands because most Americans are exceptionally docile and good. No need of coercion with a palsied people ever eager to obey the slightest nod of their masters. America, America, never shall you realize the true meaning of thoroughgoing independence and self-proprietorship until an American Cromwell or an American Caesar has signed the death warrant of an American king. The executive that sells his people into bondage is a public enemy, whether he be an elective monarch or an hereditary king. Such a scoundrel and traitor has no rights that property-holding freemen are bound to respect. No, not one. By accepting the gold of public plunderers, he makes himself an Ishmaelite. His hand is against every man's hearth and every man's property. Therefore, every man's hand should be uplifted against him. In days not long gone by, men of our race have hung bribe-takers with secret ceremony and even rolled the heads of kings into the executioner's basket. If we are not now to be robbed of everything we possess and reduced to conditions of absolute state servitude, we must not shrink from doing so again. Despotism, if it is to be overthrown, must be fought with its own weapons, and the vilest of despotisms are ever founded upon majority votes. As for the common people, they are energetically chasing shadowy paternalisms and allowing their substance to be appropriated on a gigantic scale. They are living in a fool's paradise of progress and peaceful industrial evolution, as the cant phrases go. Some of these days they may possibly wake up, when too late, and discover, with alarm and astonishment, that all their mock iambics have been of no avail against the insidious growth of centralized oligarchic Hebraism, ballot box desolation, and industrial imperialism. Americans have yet to learn that each generation must fight out its own good fight and not rely for the preservation of its hardihood and independence upon moth-eaten parchments nor on fraudulent statesmen now in the graveyard. Statesmen who spent their petty babblesome lives not in doing heroic things but in founding and enthroning the abominations that afflict us all today like a palsy. Our national hero worship badly wants reconstruction. 5. Many years after the Declaration was issued, our written Constitution was constructed with much voluble sophistry and mimic strife. That document, considered as a whole, is the most cunningly worded and at the same time most terrible instrument of government and mastership that any Anglo-Teutonic tribe has ever yoked itself up under. Pretending to grant liberty and self-government, it practically annihilates both. Under the show of guaranteeing personal independence and civil rights, it has organized an elective tyranny wherein the mob monarch possesses more arbitrary authority than any dynastic despot since the days of Darius or Belshazzar. The highest crime is actually written in the highest law of the land. Thus did the great guile masters their toils and their tangles set, and as wide as was the water, so wide was woven the net. Indeed, the written constitution of our republic is a monstrous mechanical contrivance that bids fair, when once it has got properly underway, to squeeze the very heart out of all the best elements in America. Our federal government may be very appropriately compared to a pirate ship cleverly disguised as a friendly armed cruiser, convoying a fleet of peaceful merchantmen loaded with an immense treasure and 70 million passengers. When it first came to their assistance, it was, oh, so kindly, so affectionate, so full of loving regard for its intended prey, for the welfare and bon voyage of its quarry. Now, however, that its 45 ships of state are out in the open ocean, and absolutely at its mercy, it strips off its decoy rig, hoists the death's head in bloody bones, opens its hidden portholes, runs out its round-lipped broadsides, and yells through the editorial speaking trumpets, "Heave to there, or you'll be blown out of the water." Thus it will be seen the Jesuitic evangel of equality has proved itself a tremendous success. It seduced the American people into a feeling of contentment and security till their bonds and fetters were properly forged, polished, and neatly riveted on. Well fashioned indeed was the net, a splendid spider web it has proved itself, and withal needful. Under the hypnotic spell of a free and equal dream, Americans have been hustled into a convict prison of laboriousness to piratical masters 1,000 times more terrible and more unyielding than any history can describe. All that is now left of liberty is its name and the harmless privilege. All that is now left of liberty is its name and the harmless privilege the common people have of scolding the proprietors in vulgar editorial diatribes at or about election times. Occasionally they do descend into the streets, indulging in sanguinary vociferations upon the same general principle that impels a mangy cur to howl most dismally, if struck with a brick. The conflict between the masters and the helots is over for the present, and the masters, having conquered, are in possession of the booty and the field.
That concludes our readings of Midas Wright for June the 9th, 2016. No more truths were ever spoken than Midas Wright. I'll be back with you tomorrow. That's Freya's Day, Friday here in the bunker. In the meantime, one closing item that you need to remember also.
And I won't. I'll just sit here and be quiet. Just in case they do suspect me. They're probably watching me. Well, let them. Let them see what kind of a person I am. I'm not even going to swat that fly. I hope they are watching. They'll see. They'll see and they'll know. And they'll say, "Why, she wouldn't even harm a fly."